Welcome to The World Today. I'm Thomas Ariti. This Tuesday, a former investment banking boss set to head Australia's financial watchdog. And could fighting between Iraqi and Kurdish forces ease the pressure on Islamic State?
I would venture that it already has. When defeating the Islamic State was a priority, then life was easy from the political angle. They're looking past the Islamic State already to the next military confrontation.
But first, it's official. The federal government has scrapped proposals for a clean energy target. Instead, MPs have signed off on a plan for what's been called the National Energy Guarantee. The government will push retailers to purchase baseload power along with cleaner energy and generators that can be turned on at short notice. Senior ministers say the proposal will lower the cost of electricity and ensure the lights remain on. But Labor says it's appalled the government has dumped plans for a clean energy target as recommended by Australia's chief scientist. Stephanie Boris reports.
Rising power bills will become a concern of the past under the latest shake-up of the energy market. That's the promise from government ministers, including Deputy Liberal Leader Julie Bishop, who's confident they've found the right way forward.
I think it's an ingenious scheme. It was suggested to us by the regulators. I'm on the Energy Subcommittee of Cabinet. I believe this will be a game changer in the energy debate.
Cabinet met last night to nut out the details. On the table was Australia's chief scientist, Dr. Alan Finkel's recommendation of introducing a clean energy target. But Julie Bishop says Cabinet has scrapped that idea.
This is a very secure way of ensuring reliability, affordability and meeting our Paris commitments. And I would suggest that Labor listen to what the experts, the energy regulators, have come up with. It doesn't require a clean energy target. It doesn't require a carbon tax. It works on market mechanisms and it will drive prices down.
The coalition party room has accepted the proposal, but the official details are still yet to be released. The ABC understands subsidies for clean energy will be phased out past 2020, while energy retailers will be required to keep a certain amount of power, a mix of coal and gas, ready to dispatch at short notice to stop blackouts. That will be known as a National Energy Guarantee. Shadow Energy Minister Mark Butler says dumping the suggestion of a CET is a bad idea.
This government appears to be hell-bent on destroying renewable energy, or at least severely restricting its growth in Australia over the coming few decades.
Under the new policy, renewable energy is expected to make up between 28 to 36% of the energy market mix by 2030. That's far below Labor's target of 50%. Mark Butler is far from impressed.
We'll place at risk thousands of jobs in the renewable energy industry and make it utterly clear that Australia is completely unable to satisfy and discharge its commitments around carbon pollution reduction that it made at the Paris conference in 2015.
But government frontbencher Steve Chobo has told Sky News the new plan will be better for consumers.
It's about where you put the heavy lifting, you see, and this is the key. So under the coalition policy, the heavy lifting is done by the energy retailers. They're the ones who have to make sure that they are complying with the two guarantees, that is reducing emissions, but also making sure that we have reliable or what's called dispatchable power.
In his review into the electricity market, Australia's chief scientist, Dr. Alan Finkel, concluded a CET was the most effective way to reduce emissions and keep the lights on. But from day one, former Prime Minister Tony Abbott argued against the idea, warning subsidies for renewables would push up power prices. Liberal MP Craig Kelly was also sceptical about the idea. He says the new proposal is the best way forward.
A lot of this plan is put together by the Energy Security Council, which includes the Australian Energy Market Operator. So we believe that we have a mechanism here that is superior to the clean energy target. And I am sure all of those groups, once they see the detail released by the Prime Minister today, will come on board and say this is good.
But how much will households save a year? That's the golden question yet to be outlined by the government. The mechanism will need the support of states and territories, and that's unlikely to be an easy task. Victoria has already voiced its disappointment at the clean energy target being dumped, while South Australia is seeking more details about the new proposal.
Stephanie Boris reporting. Well, the renewable energy industry is scratching its head about what a new energy policy might mean for its future. And it's worried that a renewed focus on coal and gas generation will slow the growth of renewables. David Cody has more.
Many in the renewable energy sector are dismayed that a key recommendation on energy policy from the government's own chief scientist has been scrapped. Kane Thornton is from the Clean Energy Council.
We're currently seeing record levels of investment in renewable energy in this country, and a clean energy target could have ensured that that continues for many years and indeed decades ahead. There's a lot of concern that we'll see stalling in investment in renewable energy ahead.
Why can't renewable energy technologies stand alone without specific policies promoting their use?
The energy sector is heavily regulated and indeed dominated by old coal-fired generation that was built indeed by taxpayers and governments around the country. And so for these reasons, we need long-term stable policy settings to ensure any new form of investment, let alone clean energy, which is now the cheapest.
Michael Gartner is the Managing Director of Photon Energy, which is building solar power plants in Australia and overseas. He says a clean energy target provides certainty around investments in the industry.
It just basically suggests that we're short-term thinkers and we're missing the point about the necessity to provide long-term contracts for infrastructure investments.
He warns policy uncertainty is making it more difficult to sign contracts.
What it means for us is that basically our growth is stifled and, you know, much slower than it would normally be. For society in general, it means that we're not meeting those targets and we're not building new energy infrastructure which would help to bring prices down and to help meet that clean energy future, which we're really, I believe, all aspiring to.
But not all people in the sector are wedded to a clean energy target. David Green is a partner with the Lion Group, which is building large solar and battery storage plants in South Australia and Victoria.
From our perspective, it's not that important to have a particular target. Solar energy is largely commercial. Now, we believe large-scale batteries are on the verge of commerciality as well. I think the need for ongoing subsidies is going to drop away quickly. Batteries can do with some government support, but what's particularly important is certainty in policy.
So what are you looking for from government and the opposition for that matter?
Well, we're looking for both parties to provide bipartisanship in energy policy. We need certainty for investment. We need to be able to transition to a new energy system with that certainty, but also with the speed at which is required to address emissions issues globally.
Phil Livingston is founder of Queensland-based renewable energy firm Redback Technologies. It uses software to coordinate energy storage and systems to reduce demand for power at peak times.
It doesn't seem to be an intelligent way of approaching the problem. What I would lend is a degree of caution to government to note that the commoditization of these technologies is not going to stop with an advocation for more fossil generation. They can fight the tide, but the reality is that the cost of these technologies continues to commoditize and reduce in cost and continue to provide greater value for consumers in being self-empowered and making their own energy choices. And companies like us, as well as several other companies in the market that are focused in this space, will continue to empower consumers accordingly.
Oliver Yates is the former head of the Clean Energy Finance Corporation. He told ABC News the government's energy policy needs to be built around keeping global warming below 2 degrees.
So the policy at the moment as it stands, it appears to be far too low in its ambitions in relation to the climate change target. It takes no consideration of Australia's national carbon budget. Secondly, the way that this policy is currently framed, it appears then what the government's doing is they're trying to limit the electricity sector's obligation to reduce emissions to a smaller percentage than what is economically sensible. And this is an important point. So the government has an obligation to reduce carbon emissions. What it needs to do is determine which sector of the economy can reduce carbon emissions in the cheapest and most effective way.
And he says it's the energy sector that can offer the best and cheapest carbon emissions reductions.
David Cody reporting. Well, further details are beginning to emerge about the government's energy plans. Our reporter Stephanie Boris joins me now from our Parliament House studio to go through the latest developments. Stephanie, what changes are being made to the energy sector?
Well, it was the worst kept secret here in Parliament House that the government wouldn't proceed with the clean energy target, and that has now been confirmed. And as to what will replace it and what will be used to ensure that we have lower electricity prices and the lights remain on is what's being called a new national energy guarantee. Now, there's two elements to this today. The first is about a reliability guarantee. So energy retailers will be asked exactly what they need. They need to ensure they've got a certain amount of power still stored to ensure that no more blackouts occur. Now, as to how much power they have to keep stored, that will be determined on a state-by-state basis because, of course, everyone has different levels of power and power supply across Australia. Now, the government insists that this is the best way forward when it comes to keeping the lights on, and they use the example of South Australia, where they have had a number of problems, and this will turn it around. The other part to it is an emissions guarantee. Now, what they'll be doing is they'll be asking energy retailers to reduce their emissions. That will be made through the government. The government's making a decision as to what that figure should be. That hasn't been made yet. That's still being worked on. And as to compliance, how you ensure these energy retailers comply with these changes, that's yet to be worked out, but it's in the process at the moment.
So what does this all mean for the average household?
That's what you and I think are most interested about here, how we can save money on our power bills. So the Energy Security Board estimates that a typical household will save up to $115 a year, and that's over the 2020 to 2030 period. Now, questions, of course, have been asked, how can you guarantee that? And that depends how well these mechanisms work. That figure has come to via modelling via the Energy Security Board, but, of course, it's still a wait and see.
And briefly, Stephanie, what's the timeline for these announcements being put into place?
Yeah, so this afternoon there's a phone hookup with all the states and territories about these changes and what they think of them. So they're hoping for final approval of a rule change by the year end 2018 and implementation in 2019.
Okay, Stephanie Boris in Canberra, thank you. The federal government has scrambled to appoint former Goldman Sachs banker James Shipton to replace Greg Medcraft as chairman of the corporate watchdog ASIC. Mr. Shipton is currently an academic in the United States, and his appointment comes days after the leading candidate, Credit Suisse Australia chairman John O'Sullivan, pulled out of contention after a long-running campaign by the shadow treasurer Chris Bowen. Well, the ABC's senior business correspondent Peter Ryan has been speaking with Mr. Shipton. Peter, just how quickly did the federal government need to move with James Shipton's appointment?
Tom, it's still unclear just when Mr. Shipton got the call, but he was a successful candidate. But the pressure was on to get a new ASIC chairman in place ASAP, well before Greg Medcraft retires on the 12th of November. Now, late last Thursday, Credit Suisse Australia chairman John O'Sullivan very publicly pulled out of the ASIC race, citing a campaign by Shadow Treasurer Chris Bowen that called out his close relationship with the Prime Minister, that Mr. O'Sullivan was a fundraiser for Mr. Turnbull, issues that, according to Chris Bowen, made him an inappropriate appointment. Now, James Shipton is being pretty careful about the exact timing of his fast-tracked appointment, and he was steering clear of the John O'Sullivan controversy. But in his first major interview as ASIC chairman-designate, James Shipton signalled he'd be maintaining the heat on scandal plague banks and financial services.
It's a tremendous honour to be able to serve with ASIC and the great men and women there. The financial system in Australia and indeed globally faces ongoing challenges after the financial crisis and also through change and evolution. I believe the challenge for ASIC and my role there will be to ensure that ASIC remains nimble, strategic, responsive and ready to take on the new challenges.
This is an at times a controversial role, and the government has conducted a worldwide search to replace Greg Medcraft. Did you apply or did they come to you?
I was approached and I was very honoured to be approached and very pleased that at the end of the very exhaustive process that I was asked to serve the community and asked to serve in this important role.
And how long did the selection process go for?
I can only speak about my own experience, which is a significant number of months.
A leading contender was Credit Suisse Australia Chairman John O'Sullivan. Like you, he's from a banking background. But have you spoken with anyone from Labor, given given their campaign against Mr O'Sullivan?
I'm not going to comment on Mr O'Sullivan, and my communications have been with the people involved in the process, and I believe that's the proper conduct for these types of searches. And I look forward to discussions with everybody on all sides of politics and all aspects and all members of the community.
You're based at Harvard in the United States. How quickly did you have to move to get over here for this announcement?
I move relatively quickly, but I'm often travelling because of the nature of my role at the Program on International Financial Systems. And as a happy coincidence, I'm on my way to Tokyo, where Harvard Law School is conducting a seminar on financial systems. And so able to move, and have always moved relatively quickly when the needs arise.
When did you get the call?
I've had the call a couple of weeks ago, but again, I've been a part of the process now, which I, again, observe has been a very rigorous one for a good number of months.
You're widely experienced in your role, given your banking background, but have you dealt with the Prime Minister, Mr Turnbull, back in the days when he was doing deals?
No, I don't believe we overlapped when we're in banking. So, no, I haven't had any professional interaction with the Prime Minister.
So, unlike Mr O'Sullivan, you're not coming in with any perceived conflicts, no issues for Labor. You see yourself as an honest broker and a very independent regulator.
Well, again, I'm not going to comment on other potential candidates, but yes, most certainly, I believe that I am very well placed with my experience, not just in banking, but also in law and academia. And of course, very importantly, being a former regulator myself.
Perhaps the biggest issue for regulators like ASIC is the behaviour of banks and insurance companies. Is that scrutiny going to get tougher with you in the top job?
I would just make the observation that the financial sector globally needs to continue to work very hard at improving its culture and its conduct. It is ongoing. It is everlasting. And I see the role of ASIC to be a guardian to ensure that the trust that is required in financial markets is promoted and advocated. And this challenge of the conduct and culture of all financial institutions is something that I'll certainly be focusing in on, and is something that will just not go away.
Have you been keeping an eye on the culture of Australia's Big Four banks, viewing from the United States?
It's a very important topic for the Big Four Australian banks, but equally it's an important topic for smaller financial institutions and for each and every financial participant to ensure that the best conduct and the best culture is being undertaken, again, to ensure that the financial markets as a whole deserve the trust that is placed in them by the community and all of those people who are investing significant parts of their life savings in the financial markets.
But given the scandals at Australia's banks, in particular the Commonwealth Bank, which is defending itself against almost 54,000 alleged breaches of money laundering, are banks living the culture, or is it just a policy that they like to roll out?
This is something that I'm going to find out more when I take up the position. I don't think that now is the right time for me to comment on any particular organisation, any particular investigation, any particular matter at hand, except to say that it is an important topic to me.
ASIC received more money under Greg Medcraft to tighten surveillance, but what do you think about a Royal Commission, which the government has been resisting and funding ASIC as a result to turn the heat up on banks and insurance companies?
I'm not going to comment on the Royal Commission proposal. I'm just going to be focusing on the really important role and undertaking that ASIC has, because that's my responsibility.
But in your briefings about the role you'll be taking on in February, did the issue of a Royal Commission come up at all?
Again, I'm not going to comment on a Royal Commission, and I'm actually looking forward to getting briefed on many of the important issues that are confronting financial markets.
James Shipton, the newly appointed chairman of ASIC, and the ABC senior business correspondent Peter Ryan is with me in the studio. Peter, given the campaign against John O'Sullivan, has there been any comment from the opposition?
Well, Tom, Chris Bowen has welcomed the appointment as appropriate and has pledged bipartisan support from Labor, but Mr. Bowen is still claiming credit for John O'Sullivan's sudden withdrawal last week, saying that would have been inappropriate and unsustainable.
The ABC senior business correspondent Peter Ryan. On air through ABC Radio and Radio Australia, streaming live on our website and via the ABC Listen app. This is The World Today. You can also follow us on Facebook and on Twitter at ABC News. Thousands of civilians are fleeing the disputed northern Iraqi city of Kirkuk as Iraqi government forces take control amid soaring tensions over last month's Kurdish vote for independence. Vehicles are stuck in a massive traffic jam, which in some places is six lanes wide. And Kurdish officials have accused the Iraqi army of carrying out a multi-pronged attack, reporting heavy clashes on the city's outskirts. But a spokesman for Iraq's state-backed militias says they've encountered little resistance, and the US is urging two of its key allies in the battle against the Islamic State group to avoid any escalation in the conflict. Barney Porter reports.
Civilians and federal troops have pulled down Kurdish flags in Kirkuk. The governor has fled to Erbil, the capital of Iraq's autonomous Kurdish zone, and Kirkuk's residents are celebrating. A spokesman for Iraq's state-sanctioned militias says they've achieved all their goals. Ahmed al-Assadi is with the Shiite militia al-Hasad al-Sha'abi. The joint military operation was launched at dawn and progressed well, he says. As the troops approached one area, they were confronted by some rebels who tried to hinder their progress. Our troops returned fire and silenced them. Cap Barzan Jabba is a Kurdish Peshmerga fighter and has a view from the other side. I was on the front line, he says. The government militia started its attack with heavy weapons and we didn't have the capabilities to confront them. They are the same weapons that America gave the militia and the Iraqi army, and they've turned them against us. And as always, there are the non-fighters who have been caught up in yet another dispute. Yusuf Ismail is one of them. We have nothing to do with all this, but the kids were terrified, he says. We were afraid that there would be explosions, that mortars and shells would fall on us. That's what I'm worried about. I have kids. Just weeks ago, both sides were fighting as allies in northern Iraq against the Islamic State group. The US has called for calm, hoping to avert an all-out conflict between Baghdad and the Kurds that would open an entirely new front in Iraq's 14-year-old civil war and potentially draw in regional powers such as Turkey and Iran. President Donald Trump.
We don't like the fact that they're clashing. We're not taking sides, but we don't like the fact that they're clashing. Let me tell you, we've had for many years very good relationship with the Kurds, as you know, and we've also been on the side of Iraq, even though we should have never been in there in the first place. We should never have been there, but we're not taking sides in that battle.
When Iraq's armed forces crumbled in the face of the IS advance in 2014, Kurdish forces moved into Kirkuk to secure the city and its surrounding oil wells. The Kurds consider Kirkuk the heart of their homeland, even though it's more than 30 kilometres outside their autonomous region in northeast Iraq. The Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi says he's simply reclaiming the city. Maha Yahya is the director of the Carnegie Middle East Centre.
I think the Kurds' strategic mistake was including Kirkuk in the referendum. According to the Iraqi constitution, Kirkuk, the status of Kirkuk was to be a subject of an independent referendum in and of itself to see how it would be dealt with. You have three different entities that are involved in Kirkuk and that have significant influence in the city. That's the central government, the Kurds, but also the Turkey through its Turkmen population. Plus there are the oil fields. So the status of Kirkuk already is a very... is disputed.
But she says it all came down to timing.
To have gone ahead with the referendum at a time when everybody was advising against it, at a time when the country, Iraq, is facing such a fractious situation and is on the defensive, was in many ways, yes, the Iraqi state is weak, but it's also very strong and is in a very defensive mood. So it was a wrong moment, if you like, to escalate things in this way.
Perhaps significantly, the Iraqi move comes as US-backed forces in Syria say they now control Islamic State's one-time capital of Raqqa, with only a few dozen militants reported to be remaining in the city. And in a region renowned for complicated ties and alliances, often depending on one's immediate goals, Iraq's central government is gaining support from several obvious sources. Neighbours Iran, Syria and Turkey also have Kurdish populations and therefore are also reluctant to see sections hived off their countryside to help create a new independent Kurdistan. In the meantime, the Peshmerga says Baghdad will be made to pay what it's described as a heavy price for triggering war on the Kurdish people.
Barney Porter. So where to next in the battle against Islamic State? On one hand, ISIS is losing valuable territory, but could the clash between Iraqi government and Kurdish forces take some pressure off the terror group? And regardless of the outcomes on the ground, will ISIS continue in another form? One theory is it'll form a virtual caliphate, uniting in cyberspace until it can reclaim physical territory. Well, I've spoken to Craig Whiteside, who's a professor of national security affairs at the Naval War College in Monterey, California, and I wanted to know exactly what a virtual caliphate could involve.
Some people use it just as a kind of a cute phrase for the cyber jihad or media jihad, the infamous and very capable ISIS propaganda or IS propaganda wing and department. So sometimes that's what they mean in a very narrow sense. But in another sense, when people are talking about the virtual caliphate, some individuals, particularly the U.S. military, describe it as a place that ISIS is going to transition into once they're defeated physically on the battlefield. And that's another more common and I think a term that's gaining acceptance, if you will.
And why is it gaining acceptance? Why has this idea grown in interest in recent times amongst people who are closely observing groups like Islamic State?
There's probably a variety of reasons, and not to project what I think they're thinking, but certainly I think it's this idea that the power of propaganda and the power of information wars, if you will, is influencing decision makers to look at that as a serious problem, possibly radicalizing elements of local populations that are very far from Syria and Iraq. So that's one reason that it's grown. But the other one is still a suspicion and maybe even misunderstanding of how information works. It really overvalues or oversells this idea that the information is what's crucial, whereas it's really, to us, the physical caliphate that is much more important. And the destruction or the reduction of the physical caliphate is much more important to and affects the information part or the cyber jihad, if you will.
Right, because when we look at the conflict involving ISIS thus far, it's largely involved territorial losses, as you say. So in other words, a fight to reclaim land. But if the group retreats to a virtual realm, what challenges could that present to world leaders in the fight against the group?
Those challenges for world leaders are front and foremost to them, and that's because of the fear that either people will leave a physical caliphate and return to home and bring those skills, and this has been often discussed, but it's also the idea that out of frustration, out of a lack of control of territory or the ability to govern even small populations, that you will see an increase in attacks across the world, like we've seen over the last 2 years as the caliphate has begun its decline, the so-called caliphate. Again, we disagree with that. We think as the caliphate shrinks, it will see a corresponding reduction in attacks of opportunity, remote attacks, as some people call them, and we'll see a reduction there, and it will coincide with the reduction of the physical caliphate. That's why the reduction of the caliphate in Syria and Iraq is so important, and it is so crucial, and not just the reduction, but a continued focus on that aspect to ensure that in the next decade, you don't see a resurgence of that caliphate pop up as you see gaps and seams in the coalition against it.
But as ISIS improves its cyber capabilities, isn't it a situation where we could see a different kind of terrorist attack emerge with a focus on the cyber realm?
That's a possibility, and it's certainly something that we're looking at for against state actors. You know, all nations are concerned about increasing capabilities of small groups and individuals, but most of them usually are associated with state powers. To the best of our knowledge to date, that ISIS's actual cyber capabilities, the abilities to hurt states, communities around the world through cyber, is exceptionally limited, if not rudimentary. So that is not the fear. The fear is, when we talk about the virtual caliphate, it isn't that there'd be cyber attacks per se, but that actually that the information, the ideas that are propagating in the cyber domain as part of the information campaign or propaganda campaign, that's what's going to be residual. And that's what can be harmful or radicalized. And that's the concern to date for policymakers.
Some might be inclined to use the word defeat when they hear about Islamic State losing territory. But is it that simple? Is ISIS being defeated simply because it's losing physical ground?
You know, there's quite a difference in how ISIS talks about defeat and what defeat would mean for them and what the coalition, the current coalition of about 80 nations that's facing them. And there's, you know, unfortunately, there's quite a discrepancy there. There tends to be a discrepancy between two opposing elements on what the definition of defeat is. But right now, the difference is so large. That is a problem, as you point out. And they have a very high bar for defeat for them. And the coalition really is thinking that the destruction of physical territory, which is important to the political movement of the Islamic State, that will be enough to cause them to be defeated. And, you know, obviously both of them are wrong, or they're looking at it from their perspective. And the truth is going to be somewhere in between, that the defeat for the Islamic State will be that it loses popularity both globally and, more importantly, locally, in the local areas that want to accept or embrace the idea that IS is selling. And that's an idea that can be damaged by, one, the loss of territory, but also, two, the idea that they were not able to protect once they established governance and came out in the open, that once they weren't able to protect the population from harm by a multiplicity of actors, that really damages the credibility of this particular caliphate project, as well as their ability to remain, the fact that they cannot sustain themselves against other actors, and not necessarily Western actors, is a problem for them that they'll have to overcome. That said, they've been defeated before. This movement is much better understood in a longitudinal sense, and going back into the Iraq War of 2003 on, and they were defeated from 2008 to 10. But the inability to finish the job against that group of people who kept the faith, and the strategic environment and the political environment that changed in Iraq and certainly changed in Syria in 2011 and gave them an opening, those factors allowed them to come back. And you can see the same thing happen in the future if we're not careful.
And cracks seem to be forming in the battle against ISIS. The US is calling on Iraqi and Kurdish forces to avoid escalating military action. Is there a chance that tension could take some of the pressure off Islamic State?
I would venture that it already has. Coalition warfare is difficult, as political aims ebb and flow and sometimes change, and they're not shared among certain actors. When defeating the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq was a priority for this multiplicity of actors, then life was easy from the political angle, and the requirements for the coalition, the people who were knitting the coalition together, and their life was probably much easier. Now it's difficult as actors look past the Islamic State and see this defeat that you're talking about. They're looking past the Islamic State already to the next political and possibly even military confrontation between actors that now want to resolve some long-standing, truly long-standing political differences.
How important are the Kurdish forces in the battle against ISIS?
They have a great reputation, but my impression, not to take anything away from the things that they've done in and around northern Iraq, is that they've been a little bit focused on their own political goals and the consolidation of territory in what could be a future, you know, political entity, Kurdistan, and is currently a political entity for that matter. So they've really reserved their energy to some degree in anticipation of a long-lasting dispute with the Iraqi government.
Craig Whiteside, a professor of national security affairs at the Naval War College in Monterey, California, and an associate fellow at the International Center for Counterterrorism. The FBI has been called in to investigate the death of a journalist in Malta who's been killed in a car bomb. Daphne Caruana Galizia was known as Malta's best investigative journalist and had done much to expose corruption among politicians, including the Prime Minister, Joseph Muscat. But as yet, it's unclear who was behind the bombing, and the Prime Minister has denounced the 53-year-old's murder as a barbaric attack on press freedom. Anne Barker reports.
Daphne Caruana Galizia was last year named as one of the most influential people in Europe. The Politico website dubbed her a one-woman WikiLeaks because of her long crusade against corruption, cronyism and lack of transparency in her homeland, Malta. Her murder from a bomb planted in her own car has shocked the small Mediterranean island. She'd just driven away from her home when the bomb exploded, sending her car flying into a nearby field. Thousands have turned out at a vigil to mourn her death, among them a family friend, Luke Frendo.
In my lifetime, it's definitely the saddest day that I've lived. As a Maltese citizen, I think Daphne was not only a journalist and an absolutely fearless human being, but a fourth pillar of everyone's democracy.
For years, Galizia wrote for newspapers, including the Times of Malta and the Malta Independent. But it was her own hugely popular blog, Running Commentary, that had the biggest impact, with daily exposés on cases of alleged corruption. Most famously, she helped expose Malta's links to offshore tax havens after they were first revealed in the so-called Panama Papers, the millions of leaked documents that were released last year by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, whose director is Australian journalist Gerard Ryle.
What we revealed in the Panama Papers in Malta was a lot of people very close to the government that have offshore entities, and some of these entities could be questioned because there were a certain business connections and other things. We're talking about the chief of staff to the prime minister and others, people in government itself. There was never been any judicial inquiry into what happened, and I think she was campaigning for that. She brought the allegations much further in her blogs. She got a source who claimed that the prime minister's wife had offshore accounts where money was going in. We at ICIJ never reported that, obviously because she had her sources and we didn't have access to her sources.
Muscat denied any accusations of corruption, but called an early election in June specifically to counter the allegations. And after giving a pledge of loyalty to Maltese voters, he was re-elected. And despite the claims against him, the Prime Minister has condemned the journalist's killing as barbaric. Galizia had been sued for libel over various accusations on her blog, and only 2 weeks ago she told police she'd received death threats. The editor of Malta's independent newspaper, Rachel Attard, says her death is an attack on freedom of speech.
Whoever is behind this whole murder, needs to be not just seen as a murder on a person, on a mother, but also on an institution, which is journalism, which is obviously one of the kingpins of democracy.
At the vigil for Galizia, mourners declared her death would not be in vain and expressed hope that other journalists would carry the torch against corruption. Gerard Ryle says that such an assassination could happen in Europe is beyond belief.
You know, we're used to at ICIJ having our reporters around the world come under threat. You know, we've had reporters, you know, being shot at in Russia. We've had, you know, a horrifying situation in Mexico where reporters are getting killed all the time. This is not what you expect in Malta, in a European country. So I guess that's probably why it's resonating so deeply.
Gerard Ryle, the director of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, speaking to Anne Barker. It appears the exodus of Rohingya refugees fleeing Myanmar into neighbouring Bangladesh has intensified. And there are reports that in one area, thousands of people are on foot attempting to flee violence and the destruction of their homes. Nick Grimm reports.
a malnourished baby cries at the Kutupalong refugee camp on Bangladesh's border with Myanmar. Thousands of men, women and children have been arriving at makeshift centres like this after making the trek from villages destroyed in violence described by the United Nations as ethnic cleansing. Hunger and sickness is rampant, as a doctor there confirms as he examines a young boy.
And you're seeing so many of these children.
Highly contagious skin infection.
Drone footage released by the UNHCR shows a human tide of refugees carrying their meagre belongings towards safety. The UN says 500,000 people have fled Myanmar since August, fueling what it's calling the world's fastest growing refugee crisis. Some have attempted to make the journey by boat. It's estimated many have drowned in the process. In the latest tragedy, 12 people, at least half of them children, were killed when their heavily overloaded vessel capsized. This man, Mohammed Rafiq, is one of the survivors.
When our homes were burnt, we had nowhere left to live, so we started walking west and eventually we reached the coast. But there were no boats and we had to wait for 10 to 15 days without food. When we finally got to the boat, he took us along a different route. Then we reached a point where the boat hit a small island and then a big wave hit our boat and it capsized.
It comes as Myanmar's de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi met with UN Political Affairs Chief Jeffrey Feltman to discuss the crisis and the UN's call to end the nation's military operations and violence in its northern Rakhine state. Security forces there have been accused of indiscriminate arson, killings and rape. But local media has focused instead on the second anniversary of the signing of Myanmar's nationwide ceasefire agreement, Aung San Suu Kyi urging armed ethnic groups to join the ceasefire.
Despite criticism of the national ceasefire agreement, there has been noticeable progress. We have successfully decreased conflict in the regions of the ethnic armed organisation signatories. And as a result, the socio-economic lives of the local people have significantly improved.
Those comments echoed by Myanmar's Armed Forces Commander-in-Chief, Min Aung Hlaing.
I would like to urge you to take the first step without hesitation towards the journey of lasting peace and union, based on democracy and the federal system that we are all pursuing.
Myanmar's powerful military chief has called the refugee crisis at the nation's borders exaggerated. Care Australia's emergency manager, Stefan Knollmeyer, says that's simply not the case.
Over the past 7 weeks or so, we've seen around 530,000 people move across the border into Bangladesh. To give you some sense of scale, that's almost the size of the entire population of Newcastle or Canberra. And still, over the last week, around 18,000 people still moving over. So it's a significant situation. These people are living in very basic situations on the Bangladesh side, very limited access to shelter, food, to water, and it's still quite serious at the moment.
Care Australia's emergency manager, Stefan Knormeyer, ending Nick Grimm's report. Human rights organisations are warning that Australia needs to clean up its act on the domestic front as it takes its place on the United Nations Human Rights Council. Australia has been elected for a 3-year term, but Oxfam, Amnesty International and the Human Rights Law Centre say Australia's own treatment of refugees and Indigenous people leaves a lot to be desired. Angela Lavoie-Pierre reports.
Australia now sits on an international council that's previously condemned its record on asylum seekers and Indigenous issues. Michael Hayworth is a spokesman for Amnesty International.
Australia's election is welcomed, but we need to end our human rights hypocrisy at home, and we need to protect the rights of Indigenous people and those who are seeking safety and asylum on our shores. The Australian government must understand that leadership requires consistency, and we must protect everybody's human rights, not just a few stated priorities of Geneva.
It's taken 2 years of campaigning for Australia to get to this point. The Special Envoy for Human Rights, Philip Ruddock, spearheaded the push for a seat on the 47-member council, spending more than $200,000 to pitch Australia in 23 countries. Australia was competing against Spain and France for one of the two available spots on the council before France withdrew its bid. The Foreign Minister, Julie Bishop, says she's proud of the achievement and that Australia will play a key role on the body.
We are a principled and pragmatic voice when it comes to human rights. Our focus will be on a number of issues, including the empowerment of women, Indigenous rights, strong domestic human rights institutions and the like.
But Michael Hayworth says Australia's elevation to the Council means it now has a special responsibility in those areas as well.
The election to the Human Rights Council, we're holding our country up as a leader of human rights on a global stage, but we've certainly neglected human rights at home. You know, we lock up Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children at a rate of 25 times that of non-Indigenous children. We've got people languishing in camps on Nauru and Manus who've come here seeking our help and safety.
Yesterday, a coalition of community and human rights groups delivered a letter to the UN in Geneva outlining what it described as Australia's backward slide on human rights. The head of policy at Oxfam, Nicole Biskey, shares that view.
We're concerned that the victory is pretty hollow unless the government actually focuses on improving its own policies in a number of human rights areas. And we're particularly concerned about Indigenous rights and refugee issues.
Dr. Biskey warns Australia may even be subject to extra scrutiny on those issues because of its new status.
It's entirely possible. Every country in the United Nations is examined on its human rights record on a regular basis in the Human Rights Council.
The criticism from human rights organisations extends beyond Australia's domestic policies. Anna Brown from the Human Rights Law Centre says Australia has an important role to play in the Asia-Pacific region, and it's been falling short.
Too often, our government turns a blind eye to serious violations, whether in Myanmar or Sri Lanka or elsewhere, and it needs to be speaking out about these abuses in our region and being a principled leader of human rights.
She believes Australia will have plenty of influence on the Council, all the more if it improves its own record.
I mean, there's some good examples of Australia advancing our human rights issues and being an effective player at the Council, and I think one example is issues around sexual orientation and gender identity. And Australia's been an effective player at the Council in promoting protections for LGBTI people across the globe. But obviously there's other examples where Australia needs to be standing up and needs to be speaking out and taking principled positions and not picking and choosing where it's going to stand up for human rights.
Anna Brown from the Human Rights Law Centre, ending that report from Angela Lavoie-Pierre. Our northern neighbour, Timor-Leste, says it will be ready by the end of the year to sign a new treaty with Australia on divvying up more than $30 billion of oil and gas reserves in the Timor Sea. Australia effectively agreed to give up its claim to half of those riches under a previous deal when it entered into UN-sponsored talks with Timor in The Hague. But Canberra and Dili have agreed on the draft wording of a new treaty, and it's a big climb down on a centrepiece of Australian foreign policy that's been in place since Australia sent troops to Timor in 1999. Peter Lloyd reports.
Every Prime Minister since and including John Howard has held fast against Timor. Malcolm Turnbull will be the Prime Minister who accepts less than the 50-50 revenue split under the scuppered deal and forego billions. How many billions and on what share, Timor's ambassador to Australia, Adele Guterres, won't say. But he insists the new deal will be transformational.
Without developing the infrastructure, you really cannot diversify the economy and or encourage private sector investment, private money.
And it's revenue that's urgently needed. Timor gets 80% of its money from oil and gas. Existing wells in the Timor Sea are running dry. Last month, the country filled 3 million barrels of oil, down from a peak of twice that 5 years ago. And despite pledging not to, the government in Dili has raided the sovereign petroleum fund piggy bank for 3 years in a row. This year's drawdown is a staggering $730 million. Ambassador Guterres says the money's being used to front-load the economy.
To be developed, you really need to have a good infrastructure that allows the quick movement of goods and services.
For Australia, there is urgency of another kind, political and diplomatic pressure from the United States to clean up the contradiction of arguing for China to play by the international game in the South China Sea whilst holding to its previous position of refusing to negotiate with Timor on a maritime boundary in the same international rules-based environment. A few months ago, Australia was on the receiving end of a pointed but little publicised hurry-up in a report from the US House Armed Services Committee. It said Washington saw security benefits for itself from Australia resolving the maritime dispute and encouraged Canberra to establish a boundary in order to, quote, send a positive signal to other states regarding adherence to a rules-based order. Labor says federal cabinet should waste no time agreeing to a new deal. Foreign Affairs spokesman Senator Penny Wong.
We're very pleased that the government did shift its position and do what Labor had called for prior to the last election, which is to seek to resolve this dispute over the maritime boundary.
There's been no ministerial visits from Australia to Timor since 2013, so the treaty represents a potential diplomatic reset moment.
Peter Lloyd. Rail buffs, historians and grey nomads have made the pilgrimage to a remote part of the Nullarbor to celebrate the centenary of the Trans-Australian Railway. The line connected Western Australia to the rest of the country when it was completed in 1917, as Caroline Winter reports.
At 1:45pm Central Standard Time, Australia celebrated an important historic anniversary.
1907... Surveyors crossing Nullarbor Plain.
It was at that time, exactly 100 years ago, that the two ends of the Trans-Australian Railway were joined near Alday on the Nullarbor. Bob Sampson is Executive Officer for the National Rail Museum.
Well, it all starts with when Australia was a young colony, and there was much debate prior to Federation in 1901 whether, in fact, West Australia was going to join the Federation or not.
It was a promise by the Commonwealth of a rail line linking east and west that sealed the deal for Western Australia, finally uniting the nation as a federation of states and territories.
That was in 1901. 1912, our first sod for the construction of that 1,700-kilometre long railway line began.
5 years later, in 1917, the lines built simultaneously from Kalgoorlie in WA and Port Augusta in South Australia came together. Bob Sampson says it was an unbelievable feat in extremely inhospitable country.
And it's incredible to think that basically, almost by hand, with the aid of thousands of horses and camels, of course, the two track teams, one starting in Kalgoorlie heading east and one starting in Port Augusta heading west, took 5 years, very, very hard work, as I said, in some very, very tough terrain to build that line and link it up as they did.
2.5 million sleepers, 140,000 tons of steel.
The centenary has been commemorated in a song by Adelaide musician Mike Roberts, on Australia Post stamps and coins by the Royal Australian Mint, but also by 400 passionate train buffs who've made the pilgrimage to Alday to mark the moment.
Well, it's an interesting mix of people. We've got about 8 or 9 four-wheel drive clubs, and we've got 2 coming from Perth and 1 from Horsham and a couple from Melbourne, 1 from Sydney, 1 from Gosford. But a lot of these people, you would describe them in the grey nomad genre.
Bob Ramsey is from Regional Development Australia, Whyalla and Port Lincoln. He's been involved in organising the event, which has been a logistical challenge.
Now, to give you an idea of remoteness, it's about 370 kilometres by road northwest of Sojourner, and it's on the edge of the Nullarbor Plain. So where the site actually is, it's pretty barren there. There's not a great deal of vegetation around.
Timber monuments were unveiled at the site in 1967 on the 50th anniversary of the Trans-Australian Railway. Bob Ramsey says they've been rebuilt in steel to replace those in honour of the centenary.
There's one memorial that's been placed just to the south of the railway line and one just to the north in the original positions of the 1967 monuments. And so this will leave a lasting legacy about the importance of that railway infrastructure for Australia.
Bob Ramsey from Regional Development Australia, Whyalla and Port Lincoln, ending Caroline Winter's report. And that's all from the World Today team for this Tuesday. Linda Mottram and the PM team will be along this evening and will be back at the same time tomorrow. I'm Thomas O'Riti. Have a lovely afternoon.